Welcome to the Pursuit of Financial Happiness with Michael Shoesley, Certified Public Accountant and Registered Financial Consultant. Finding financial freedom requires accumulation and investment for retirement. Start planning for your future today. Now, here's Michael Shoesley.
Welcome to the Pursuit of Financial Happiness. I'm Michael J. Shoesley. I'm a certified public accountant, a registered financial consultant, a registered investment advisor. The Pursuit of Financial Happiness is about the accumulation towards retirement, the distribution of, of retirement, and how to make those more successful. Last week, we had a call, and it led to a small discussion on annuities. Basically, everybody could use an annuity. If you have a pension, you're going to have a pension. That is an annuity. The problem with purchasing an annuity in retirement is liquidity. Do you have enough money from other sources to live on if you can't get to the money in the annuity, or the distributions for the annuity without penalties are not going to be sufficient for each year of your retirement? And of course, if you do proper retirement planning, you know what your needs are in each year of retirement. And annuities are not appropriate in the accumulation towards retirement, because you should be maximizing all of your deferred and all of your spouse's deferred retirement opportunities first before you consider that type of deferral. Variable annuities, as everybody knows who listens to this show, are too expensive. There are, however, no-load annuities out there from a variety of different sources. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily better. Sometimes they have less rider options also. Understand that a lot of variable annuity companies are reevaluating their products because of the pressure of trying to provide guaranteed income rider options. Some variable annuity companies have found that their guaranteed withdrawal payments for life are causing a problem with the death benefit, and that wasn't known or disclosed. Fixed index annuities are very complicated. They are a fixed product, however, even though they have an option to get more upside through some type of index participation, which is usually limited and capped or curtailed in some manner or form. Problem with any annuity is going to be the surrender period. I don't like to see a surrender period longer than 6 years for somebody who, for a deferred product for somebody in retirement or approaching retirement. The longer the annuity period, that's oftentimes because they're given a bonus, whether that bonus is credited at the beginning or booked at the beginning, but not credited until later or partially during the period that happens, is something that you got to look into. Plus, fixed index annuities also have moving parts, which means that the expenses can change from year to year. Some do not have any moving parts. Some will give you a minimum fixed interest because it's a fixed annuity on 100% of your premium. Some only do it on a percentage of the premium. There are a variety of things that you have to look at in a fixed index annuity to see if it's going to be a good product, because there are some good products out there and there are some bad products out there. There are also fixed annuities, which everybody is pretty much familiar with, but understand that there are new fixed annuities now that also have a lifetime income benefit available for them. What you're looking for is, as I say, you need to watch out for liquidity, and you need to watch out for the surrender period and a variety of other things. It can get real complicated. But it was a good question. Last week, I mentioned that CIT Group, which is a smaller bank that lends to medium-sized retailers and vendors to retailers. Their drama this week has been playing down. What you saw was the FDIC did refuse them. Treasury looked to help them and then backed off and said, okay, well, we'll let our primary shareholder, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, look into it for us. And so CIT was discussing with them, looking for a loan around $3 billion or some type of money in that nature, Some people think they need $6 billion. Those kind of broke down, and now they're basically talking to J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, maybe Goldman Sachs and Barclays about the possibility of lining up some type of funding, perhaps a debtor-in-possession funding that would make for a quick bankruptcy. There's some bondholders out there who are also trying to get something together to get them some money. But basically, Treasury wasn't concerned because they felt that the, you know, CIT's customers could be picked up by J.P. Morgan or Deutsche Bank, although there's some controversy about that. There are about 1,053 European collateralized debt obligations that are rated by S&P as investment grade. They contain CIT in them. One of the largest bondholder of CIT is PIMCO. So they have $2.3 billion from TARP, you know, which the government will lose if they go into bankruptcy. We'll see what happens, you know, there. But they're basically a bank that lent money to vendors to supply goods to retailers or to retailer companies. And, you know, this is part of the growing problem out there with respect to loans and liquidity. Because the small businesses or medium-sized businesses can't get money to continue their business as they normally would be expected to do, then more and more commercial loans go bad. It's just like the credit bubble. If people aren't working or they're having money, you know, running their businesses, et cetera, they're going to have trouble paying off their credit cards. If the credit card companies are raising the interest rates and lowering the limits for borrowing, that only further impacts upon those individuals and those businesses, those small businesses. And that makes more and more loans worse for the banks. Even though their banks are trying to protect themselves, they're making the situation worse, even though they're making more money. Well, we saw also inflation this week. It rose 0.7%, which is the largest increase since, I think, in 2000, from a month in 2008. However, the inflation rate for all items is went down from a negative 1.28 from last month to a negative 1.43 for this month, because if you look at the month a year ago, that's when gasoline prices were high, so that's why, you know, the all items inflation rate annualized is higher, is a larger number than it was last month. So it's a negative 1.43. Even though it went up 0.7, which is, you know, the largest one in almost a year or so, monthly increase. If you go to 1990 and look at that calculation for inflation, it would be 1.8% positive. If you go to the 1980 inflation calculation, it would be a positive 6%. If you look at total money supply, M3, it's approximately 6.3%. So what you have is a situation in which you're seeing an increase in inflation, but we're still seeing some deflationary movement. Core prices are at a positive 2.1 without food and energy. Retail sales were retail sales were up 0.6%. They expected 0.4. Retail business inventory was down 1% in May. Sales in May were down 0.1%, and ratio was 1.42 months. But in June, sales went up 0.6%, and that was primarily gasoline and some autos. On the producer price index, it was up 1.8% in June. They expected 0.9%. The core was up 0.5%. They expected 0.1%, so that was a big jump. But understand that on the consumer side of that, what you're seeing in that 1.8%, that is, if you exclude gasoline and some auto sales, it actually declined 0.2%. So when the news media was pumping both of these figures, they weren't being real honest with you, or else they just didn't understand. But you also saw this week that there were some rallies in the market. On Monday, the rally marketed because the banking analyst Meredith Whitney said banks going towards the future look like they might be more likely to be buys. She mentioned Goldman Sachs the day before its earnings. We'll get into that a little bit later. But what they left out was she said also that that unemployment's probably going to go to 13.1%. Again, you're seeing a news-driven market. On Thursday, the market rallied because one of the Dr. Doom economists who's always giving bad news about the economy, Mr. Rubini, was quoted as saying that the worst of the economic and financial crisis may be over. Unfortunately, Jim Leach was not listening, and they did not catch the context of his speech. Because basically, what he was saying was that he sees no economic growth before the end of 2009. He also sees the possibility, he reiterated, of a double-dip recession toward the end of next year. Simply put, I am not forecasting economic growth before year's end. That's not exactly what the media was saying. And he was also saying that while the recession will be over by the end of the year, the recovery will be weak given the debt overhang in the household sector, the financial system, and the corporate sector. And now there is also a massive releveraging in the public sector and unsustainable fiscal deficits and public debt accumulation. So he basically called the media later on and basically said, you didn't get it right. You weren't listening. But the news reports are still quoting, that he was saying that it's going to be, going to be better. And we're going to be taking a break now and coming back at 217-629-7970.
970 WMAY, the news and talk of Springfield, the capital city's choice for news.
Welcome back to Pursuit of Financial Happiness. I'm Michael J. Schuessler. You can reach us here at 217-629-7970 with any comments or questions. If you want to email a question, the email address for the radio show is mjscpa@sbcglobal.net. On Wednesday, the stock market rallied because supposedly the Federal Reserve and their minutes of the last meeting, open market meeting, supposedly saw the economy improving. However, if you look at the actual minutes, what you see is participants projected that real gross domestic product, GDP, would contract over the entirety of this year and that the unemployment rate would increase in coming quarters. For 2009, they're seeing a contraction of a negative 1.5 to a negative 1.0, unemployment of about 10.1 by the end of this year. They also said with the strong adverse forces that have been acting on the economy likely to abate only slowly, participants generally expected the recovery to be gradual in 2010. And they also said the economy is at risk to further shock. So what you see here is a lot of people grasping for straws. They're not acting as if there's no hope in getting things done. They're looking for hope coming around the corner all the time, and they're going to drag it, even if they can't find it. So it's watch out. Paul Krugman was saying at this point, the acute crisis has given way to a much more insidious threat. Most economic forecasters now expect gross domestic product to start growing soon, if it hasn't already, but all signs point to a jobless recovery. On average, forecasters surveyed by the Wall Street Journal believe that the unemployment rate will keep rising until next year and that it will be as high at the end of 2010 as it is now. It's bad enough when you're jobless for a few weeks. If it's going to be months or years, there's no hope. You're going to lose your home. You're going to be homeless. In fact, 1 in 9 people are delinquent on their mortgages right now. What you're also seeing is the economist Robert Shiller was also saying that a second stimulus is needed, just as Mr. Krugman has been saying for a long time, and I've been saying for months and months and months. We're also seeing that there's some federal people who are trying to say that the Fed shouldn't oversee the systemic risk because the regulations being proposed aren't strong enough. That includes a former Securities and Exchange Commission chairman, Raymond Donaldson, and Arthur Levitt, who were both SEC chairmen. Also included people like Brixley Bourne, Bill Miller of Legg Mason, and Harvey Goldschmidt, a former SEC commissioner. The group is suggesting an independent oversight board. Banks should focus on the primary purposes, taking deposits and making loans. And their serious concerns stem from the Fed's recent regulatory failures. Sheila Bair of the FDIC is pushing for tougher measures to curb the size and risk-taking of the nation's largest financial firms. They will propose slapping fees on the biggest bank holding companies to the extent that they carry on activities such as proprietary trading outside of traditional lending. And that's going to be a real, problem, going forward. Goldman Sachs, for quarter two, reported profits of $2.7 billion, which were an increase of 33% from the prior quarter. That's $4.93 per share. It's primarily coming from trading income and investment income, which was up $1.44 billion. That's up, so the trading income was up 75% versus quarter one, down 15%, however, versus a year ago. They also had a one-time charge of $426 million. With respect to their TARP repayment. However, they also set aside $6.65 billion for compensation. So they set aside more than twice for compensation what they made in the quarter on an annualized basis. And Krugman tore into him a little bit, basically saying... that this tells us that Goldman is very good at what it does, but what it does is bad for America. It shows that Wall Street has bad habits. The system of compensation to help cause the financial crisis has not gone away. Third, it shows that by rescuing the financial system without reforming it, Washington has done nothing to protect us from a new crisis and, in effect, has made another crisis more likely. He particularly points out that Goldman famously made a lot of money selling securities backed by subprime mortgages, then made a lot more money by selling mortgages-backed securities short just before their value crashed. It's all about making money. It also came out this week that Bank of America and probably Citibank also are under a secret memorandum of understanding from the government, which means that they have to address deficiencies within... their banks, and dealing both with administration and with reserves and their balance sheets. Memorandum of understanding is secret, so we're going on third-party statements that are widely quoted. Bank of America is trying to avoid paying billions of dollars in fees to U.S. taxpayers for guarantees against losses at Merrill Lynch. They owe about $4 billion. Bank of America saying is, well, hey, the government wanted us to list all these assets and before the agreement was final, and we never got around to listing all those assets, so it never got finalized. So we really don't have an agreement, even though we benefited from the implied guarantees. And even though we said that we had those guarantees in public statements. So some people are saying, well, maybe, the government is, should get at least a third of that. But I imagine this is just another situation in which the banks will say, hey, we don't got to pay you, and you can't make us, and we're not going to. Also, AIG's European derivatives may take decades, tens of years, to expire because instead of being, for only 1 year or a short six-year period of time or less— some contracts for corporate loans were almost 45 years. Some mortgage swaps were more than 30 years in Europe. Societe Generale and BNP Paribas, which are two European banks, hold almost $200 billion of these guarantees, and they have no necessity to get rid of them because they're in the money. So much for the fast wind down for AIG. And we're going to be taking a break right now and coming back to 217-629-7970. Welcome back to the Pursuit of Financial Happiness. I'm Michael J. Schussle. We're here at 217-629-7970. You can reach us at mjscpasbcglobal.net. And keeping on with the banks, I understand that the Congressional Oversight Panel is very upset because the Treasury Department's only getting about 48% of the value of the warrants when the banks are repaying their TARP amounts to get those warrants back, and because the Treasury Department refuses to use the standardly accepted Black-Scholes model for valuing those types of securities. And that's pretty much going through the board. State Street, when they paid a week ago last Friday, they paid, they basically paid about 24% of what the warrants times the stock price that day that they paid it back. But still, you got people like banks like J.P. Morgan say, hey, Treasury wants too much money. Go ahead. They can auction them off if they want. You know, so the banks are just real insistent they're not going to pay this money back because they only had it a short time and it's not a fair amount of money to pay back. You try that when you're on your loan with the bank. The Justice Department is investigating if banks, which own the London-based CDS data provider, in other words, this is Market Group, they provide day-in values of, credit default swaps. And they're, investigating whether these banks, because they own this company, have an unfair access to price information. The four biggest owners are J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Royal Bank of Scotland, and Goldman Sachs. J.P. Morgan quarter two profit was up 36%, $2.7 billion, 28 cents a share. But it doubled its bad loan reserves on credit loan problems to $9.7 billion versus a year ago. Citigroup profit was $4.28 billion, 49 cents a share. Its sale of Smith Barney's joint venture yielded $6.7 billion in profit in gain. But if you exclude that, it had an operating loss of 27 cents per share. When you're looking at these reported profits, you have to look at all the numbers that are in the report. You want to look for the operating loss. What's the operating loss? Bank of America profit fell 35% to $3.22 billion, which is 33 cents a share. GE profits declined 46%. GE Financial has significant real estate investment exposure, and they're having some problems with those investments. And GE is just not going to let GE Financial go because it can be a real profit cow in good times. Now, as we said at the end of, during the quarter one earnings period, you got to understand when you're talking about these bank profits, that under the new lax accounting rules, the relaxed mark-to-market, which allow books banks to book lower losses on the actual troubled assets and all in the reductions in reserves for future losses resulting from loan problems and mortgage modifications. What happens is that it obfuscates, it just clouds the whole balance sheet and earnings with hefty gains. Earnings because of those lax rules, and also because they're having some hefty gains on their mortgage investment portfolios, i.e. the bonds and the mortgage servicing fee rights. In fact, since 2000, mortgage banking represented about 3% of revenue for Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, but in quarter two of 2009, it represented 6.4%. On the other hand, the government is considering helping out homeowners who lose their homes by perhaps instituting a program that will allow them to continue living in the home that they lost by having the right to rent. Big help. Can't think of anything that'd be more demeaning. What we're also seeing is the Ottozar Ratner left, is leaving his job because the, quote, job is done, unquote. Also, at the same time, the governor is ramping up its investigation of his former private equity firm for improper payments to get New York pension business. The U.S. industrial production in June was down 0.4%. The New York Empire State Manufacturing Index rose to a negative 0.6%, which is the highest since April of 2008. U.S. factory output is down 0.6%. Manufacturing capacity fell to 64.8%, which is the lowest since data was collected from 1948. For the second week in a row, weekly jobless data was skewed by seasonally adjusted calculations, which would include normal July auto layoffs, which would be expected. But as we all know, those layoffs occurred some time ago. So it made, for the second week in a row, it looks like unemployment is falling in the sense of jobless claims, when that's probably not accurate. Weekly jobless claims fell 42,000 to 522,000. Continuing claims fell to 6.273 million from 6.92 million. And the four-week average fell to 584,500 from 607,000. Housing starts were up 3.6% in June. That's the highest level in 7 months. Now, we understand that in some parts of the country, the housing market isn't as bad as other parts of the country. But still, when you have an existing housing inventory that's going to take more than a year to clear, why is there significant building going on? Obviously, because in those particular areas, people see that they're going to be able to make a profit. But it shows you the incongruities of what's happening within different parts of the country. And it's not going to help get the job done overall. Foreign investors sold their U.S. sold U.S. Treasuries in May to the extent of $82.2 billion, which was up from $43.3 billion in April. So foreign investors are selling more U.S. Treasuries and getting rid of them. China failed for the third time in 2 weeks to sell its target of 182-day bills. They sold 18.5 billion of 20 yuan, they were offering 20 billion of yuan, which is their currency. Coalition of Insurance Trade Associations are lobbying to be excluded from the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Big surprise. Financial advisors who are also likely to be included under the Consumer Financial Protection Agency are, saying, well, yeah, we want, more fiduciary standards, but gee whiz, you need to understand that, certain unavoidable conflicts of interest need to be excluded. It's like I say in the past, they needed to have stronger grandmothers, grandmothers who were going to say, no, that's not a white lie. No, a conflict of interest is a conflict of interest. But the federal regulations and the laws are set up to regulate salespeople. So they have certain advantages that a real fee-only advisor doesn't have. And you got people under federal regulations who call themselves fee-only advisors because they only charge for a plan or advice. But they are doing it with tools and software from a broker-dealer advisor because they're not the registered investment advisor. Their broker-dealer is the registered investment advisor. And even though they might not be selling you products, are they getting stock options? Are they getting annual rewards for assets under management? Are they getting reductions in what those tools and software cost them or their annual fees are to participate in the services of the broker-dealer advisor? That's called soft money, and that could be very economically important. All of my software, all of my research tools are third-party independent professional tools, and they're not cheap. But hey, they can call themselves fee-only advisors. Chinese Central Bank is promoting the use of their currency, the yuan, rather than the U.S. dollar in five border trading cities to settle trades by offering tax breaks to companies who use the Chinese currency. What we're also seeing is long-term care in 2009. The median annual rate for private nursing home room is $74,208. The average median rate for home health aid services is $31 per hour. Does everybody need long-term care insurance? Yes, everybody needs long-term care insurance. Can everybody afford long-term care insurance? No. Can everybody get long-term care insurance? No. And you have to be careful with long-term care insurance also, because you got to look at the exclusion days. You got to look, if you go into a nursing home and out of a nursing home, what's the waiting period in between, if any? Is there a life, you know, is there a death benefit? Is there a return of premium? What's the maximum, you know, that you can get? What's it going to cost you each year? How much is the premium going to go up or likely to go up each year? Yeah, so that's another situation where, yeah, a lot of people, you know, a lot of advisors are going to tell you, you need long-term care insurance. You sure do. You need that protection. Now, I have just a couple of policies here you can choose from. I'd be more than happy to sell them to you. That's what they'll say to you. You know, yes, you do need long-term care insurance, but can you afford it? Is it going to work for you? What else you got going on? And the best years to buy it are between like 55 and 60 if you're in good health. Well, we're also seeing is that some people are saying that proprietary, you know, one analyst is saying that proprietary trading may cause a stock market crash in October. Basically, the individual was arguing that there's premature green shoot optimism, which will turn black as the recovery does not materialize or is not apparent, which will automate proprietary trading desks, which have large short positions, particularly in October. Interesting thesis. Who knows? Morgan Stanley is planning to downgrade their loan collateralized debt obligations and put them into AAA-rated bond securities, about $87.1 million worth. So they're just going to reclassify them as AAA securities by restructuring in a process known as re-remix. And Goldman Sachs is going to get a lot of money for helping them do that. And what you're seeing also is that, you're seeing, people are piling into treasuries and they're getting out of treasuries. Some people are getting into them because of the security of the money, even though they have low yields. On the other hand, a lot of people are abandoning treasury exactly because of the low yields. And a lot of, institutional investors are saying 10-year treasuries yielding 3%, are not an investment. Why should we consider them? And it has to do with what I've been talking about with respect to the bond bubble and the possibility of a bond bubble. And then you also have people like Paul Krugman talking about the paradox of thrift, which is when people start to save more, it causes the economy to fall in the recession. One implication is that we're living in a paradox of thrift world as the folly demands that we reduce budget deficits in the near term. Slashing spending or raising taxes right now wouldn't just deepen the slump, it would actually make us poorer in the future, too. A sharp increase in personal savings has been accompanied by a decline in overall national saving. Sharp increase in personal saving has been accompanied by a decline in overall national saving, partially via reduced corporate savings, largely via increased public deficits. So that's the paradox of thrift. Right now, we're going to be taking a break and coming back at 217-629-7970 and do the market report.
970 WMAY, the news and talk of Springfield, where we never stop challenging the status quo.
Welcome back. back to the Pursuit of Financial Happiness. I'm Michael J. Schussle. We're here at 217-629-7970. You can reach me anytime at 217-793-6560. I'm a fee-only impartial advisor. Retirement planning, estate planning, investment advice, investment management, business management consulting, per hour only. What you saw in the market this week was that it was very news-driven, as we already talked about. In the prior 4 weeks, the S&P 500 declined 7%. The market went up 7% this week. Now, understand that when the market went up this week, it didn't recoup everything it lost the 4 weeks prior, because 7% of 93% is not 7% of 100%. On Dow, the Dow on Monday was up 185.16 on up volume of 29%. The NASDAQ was up 37.18 on up volume of 13.3%. Tuesday, the Dow was up 27.81 on down volume of 17.8%. It basically bounced at the end to a gain. NASDAQ was up 6.52 on down volume of 1.9%. Wednesday, the Dow was up 256.72 on up volume of 40%. On the same day, that was the day of the Fed rally, remember? Yeah. Also, the VIX, which is the index measuring volatility, jumped over 20, jumped several points over, up, and so it was over 25. So that was contrary to the market going up. NASDAQ was up 63.17 on up volume of 36.6. On Wednesday, both the Dow and the NASDAQ dropped the distribution day, so they're both down to four distribution days each now. On Thursday, the Dow was up 95.61 on down volume of 14.1. NASDAQ was up 22.13 on down volume of 18%. Friday, the Dow was up 32.12 on up volume of 9.8. The NASDAQ was up 1.58 on down volume of 9.5%. Dow for the week was up 597.42. NASDAQ was up 130.58. This is a good reason why I have been telling people to have that 8% stop loss on individual stocks if you own individual stocks. I have not, as I have at various times in the past, recommended to people that they should be totally out of individual stocks. The market is not yet in correction. So you need to listen carefully to what I say and not make assumptions. And do your own research. What you're still seeing in this marketplace, and I was looking, this week, no stocks, really broke out of basis. There weren't any leaders forming, during this week. Market's up 7%, and we don't see any leaders emerging? Excuse me? Monday, oil was down 20 cents to $59.69. The dollar was stronger. That was the day that Meredith Whitney said banks should be good investments and unemployment would be 13.1% in the future. Tuesday, oil was down 17 cents to $59.52. The dollar was stronger but mixed against the pound, that's pound sterling. The NASDAQ and the NYSE both extended their suspension of the $1 delist rule, to trade on exchanges, until the end of July. So you can still be below a dollar and trade on the NASDAQ and the NYSE until the end of July. Wednesday, oil was up $2.02 to $61.54. The dollar is weaker but mixed against the yen. The oil supply was down 2.8 million barrels. Gas supplies were up 1.5 million barrels. Distillates were down 600,000 barrels. Refinery capacity was at 85%. The Philly Fed factory activity declined to a negative 7.5 in July from a negative 2.2. That was a decline. Thursday, oil was up 48 cents to 62.02. The dollar was weaker. The MGIC investment, which is a mortgage insurer, had quarter two losses of $339.8 million, or $2.74 per share loss, and will stop writing new mortgage insurance business. American Express has stopped all U.S. and United Kingdom employer retirement contributions. So if you work for American Express, they're not going to make any more employer contributions. for you. Friday, oil was up 154 to 63.56, and the dollar was stronger. Notice, you know, last week I talked about that oil analyst and inflection points on whether oil would go up to, towards 75 or down towards 40. On Friday, it went past that inflection point towards 75. So you might want to keep that in mind. See what really happens. Because, you know, even that analyst is saying, given the supply and the demand, the prices going up are crazy. What you had also is there are people who are seeing that the price of oil and gasoline has been on the rise since the beginning of the year, and spending has been constrained by a decision on the part of many households to rebuild their depleted bank accounts. And there's falling unemployment and rising unemployment are also exerting a drag on consumer spending. Basically, they're seeing that the market is weak, that the real estate values, oil energy prices, depleted savings and unemployment, and state and local cutbacks are all hurting the overall economic recovery. And there's not as much reason for optimism as some people would like to say. In that public-private investment partnership that the government, you know, was promoting, instead of $125 billion being involved in that, it's only going to be a program amounting to $40 billion. There's going to be 9 money managers, of which BlackRock is probably going to be, you know, the largest one raising money to participate. But the largest bond trader, PIMCO, pulled out. They're refusing to participate. They're not interested anymore. Deutsche Bank has estimated that U.S. banks will need to raise $300 billion to cover growing credit losses and future capital requirements. $120 billion may be needed to rebuild Tier 1 common equity. That's just Deutsche Bank's response. So when you listen to these bank profits, listen to what I'm also telling you. And I want you to save and save some more until next week on The Pursuit of Financial Happiness.
You've been listening to The Pursuit of Financial Happiness with Michael Shusley. Remember, research, find a professional advisor to work with, accumulate by saving and investing, maximize your savings and investments, and then save more. Make wise choices with one eye on the now and the other on the future. Call Michael at 793-6560. That's 793-6560.